This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So we're going to talk about what happens after carotid intervention, and talk a little bit about minor stroke. And some I'll include some events in the minor stroke category that you might not have considered to be appropriate for the to be included, but I'll show some outcomes that suggest they should be. So I'm not an opponent of carotid stenting. I just think that we're doing carotid endarterectomy to protect the brain, and until we can show that we really can equally protect the brain with stenting as we can with endarterectomy, I think we're on the horns of a dilemma, as has been shown here just in the previous speaker. So everybody's familiar with the CARES data. The combined endpoint was equivalent, but there are increased strokes with stenting and increased MI with endarterectomy. So the vascular community, the neurology community said, stenting has more strokes, and that has effectively limited the number of stenting stents that have been applied both in this country and around the world. Possibly in response to that, for whatever reason, there was secondary analysis of the CREST trial showing that, as predicted, there was decreased survival after periprocedural MI, saying, well, wait a minute, those periprocedural MIs actually are important, and we should pay attention to them. And indeed, it's modestly impressive, and you would, as I say, as we would predict, there's a three and a half fold increased mortality after MI and after a biomarker rise. Is that a minor MI? So looking at this data, the data itself is a little less impressive just because the numbers are so small. But the bottom line is that out at 4 years, if you did not have an MI, your risk of death was 6%. If you did have either a biomarker positive event or an actual EKG positive event, your survival, your risk of survival was lower, or your risk of death was lower, excuse me. So moving on to talk about strokes and minor strokes, we need to pause for a moment and get some definitions here. So I want you to answer if you can tell if a patient has had a periprocedural stroke. Yes, when there's a change, the patient knows, the family knows, and I know. B, no. C, maybe, but it's often quite subtle. Well, you could knock me over with a feather. I'm up here. All right, so let's move on and talk about minor and major strokes. And the question is, are there really NIH consensus guidelines on what constitutes a major and minor stroke? Yes, they're commonly used to grade deficits after stroke. There's even an article about defining that. B, or not. B, no, the neurologist can't agree on anything. And C, not sure. Well, actually, Fisher defined in this article 18 definitions of the difference between major and minor stroke, and then, with all due humility, proposed a 19th. This would explain why, when you're talking about periprocedural stroke in the CREST trial, you had 300 potential events, which were adjudicated by 6 stroke neurologists. 46 were deemed to be TIA or amaurosis fugax, and 81 were adjudicated as stroke, but 69 were periprocedural, and they decided that 56 of these were minor and 13 were major. Now, the question is this a minor stroke? Well, symptomatically, unbelievably, it is. But would you call it a minor stroke if it was yours or your family's? So, and to cut to the chase here, The article concentrates on the four-year outcomes, which if your risk of death is twice as high, almost, if you had a stroke as if you didn't. But what's really impressive is the one-year data, because your risk of events after the stroke, you know that this is the paraprocedural time that the events happen. It's really within the first year that these patients have the higher risk, actually a six-fold risk of death at 1 year. I kind of think the patients would like to know that. This is also addressed in the vascular surgery group of New England's registry. They had 8,000 cases that were stenting or endarterectomy. And at 1 year, the risk of death was 16% if you had an MI, 23% if you had a stroke, a significant difference. And these differences go away at 5 years. But this is a pretty remarkable mortality rate in this group. And compared to if you had neither stroke nor death, your risk of death at 1 year was 4% and 20% at 5 years. I was looking at Linda's slides and saying, I bet there are some pretty high-risk people here that are getting interventions. Just recently in JVS from Italy, there's an interesting article and begins to get a data point which I think we really need to include. In the old VA trial, the asymptomatic trial, which nobody talks about anymore, which was done in the 80s, TIA was included as an endpoint because Bob Hobson thought that it was important. I wasn't so sure at the time, but in retrospect, I think Dr. Hobson was right on. So the survival if you had a stroke at 5 years, this is survival data, not death data, survival was 68%, 78% if you had a TIA, so it wasn't as bad as a stroke, but it was much worse than if you had neither a TIA or a stroke. Now what's interesting about this is that, as you would expect, the red line is the stroke, yellow line is TIA, blue line is no event. The mortality risk after a stroke is indeed front-loaded, but there's also a fall-off later, and most of the TI-related events actually are related, are late. So you wonder what this is actually due to, whether it's just a marker of more extensive disease, but clearly it correlates with a reduced survival. Just to add to this, their data here. This is a natural history study. It is not related to paraprocedural events. This is a Dutch study reported in The Lancet several years ago, but I think is still illustrative that TIA is an important marker of future risk. So these patients presented with a TIA at day zero, either to their hospital or their neurologist, were entered into the registry. And as you would expect, the red line is the stroke risk. Stroke risk is front-loaded. So most of this risk, as you would expect, is in the first year, year or two. The blue line is the mortality, which continues to rise. The general population mortality is down here just over 1%. So TIA clearly marks a patient group with a reduced future survival. For stroke, symptomatic stroke, I think the reason that there's a reduced survival, we can all surmise because we've unfortunately had some experience with that. We like to keep that to an absolute minimum, of course. This is the SF36 data from the CREST trial. Notice the scale here. This is major stroke, minor stroke, MI. That's cranial nerve palsy, sorry. And what you see is after major stroke, these are all negative impactors on quality of life. Minor stroke, many of these are not quite so severe, and you'll see the scale actually shifts here. But two of them are your role, your physical role, assessment of your physical role, and your assessment of your emotional well-being. We know that depression and your sense of well-being in terms of what you can accomplish is intimately tied to survival. That's now, you know, a factor, and one of our colleagues is actually looking at that in terms of people with cardiovascular disease. Those who are registered as being depressed do much less well in their long-term follow-up than those patients who are not. So I presume that's part of it. This is MI, certainly people are not happy they had an MI, but it's much less of an effect, even with this scale, which is much broader than the scales for a major and minor stroke. Cranial nerve palsy actually hardly affects people at all, which I thought was very reassuring. So the late outcomes after carotid endo intervention, paraprocedural MI is bad, stroke is worse. Minor stroke and even TIA substantially reduce long-term survival. Well, what about silent infarcts? I'll lay dollars to donuts that they also negatively impact late survival, just like TIAs. But that's my hypothesis. We have no data. I think it is very important that we are in a new era where we recognize that paraprocedural outcomes are only part of the cost of intervention. And seeing so, I do have a little time here. I will show you one more slide, which is British data on the survival of the general population in Oxford versus the population that has a TIA and the population that has a stroke. We need to pay attention to this. And I think the Silk Road device, which was mentioned, may be a very good adjunct to carotid stenting. But until carotid stenting can show that it protects the brain as well as endarterectomy, I think we still need to be cautious, and certainly cautious, as was pointed out, with those patients that are very high risk for carotid stenting. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.